This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
And Doucet Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
Word of Mouth.
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 Daddy. Concentrate. Concentrate. But Daddy.
Learning to walk, it's one of the first milestones in a human life, signifying a step toward independence. But for some, walking holds even deeper meaning. Take the writer Charles Dickens, a passionate ambulator with a 20-mile-a-day habit. Dickens once wrote, "If I could not walk far and fast, I think I should just explode and perish." In an essay she called Street Haunting, Virginia Woolf reflected on the solace she found in walking, stating, "To walk alone in London is the greatest rest." And in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, C.S. Lewis, a daily stroller, wrote, "Walking and talking are two very great pleasures, but it is a mistake to combine them." Tapping into the meditative benefits of walking is hardly unique to the world's great literary minds. From the religious pilgrims of the ancient world to Neil Armstrong's first steps on the moon, walking is not just part of human history. It's part of being human. It's how we evolved.
As far as I know, it was every day, rain or shine. This was an essential part of his daily sort of intellectual routine.
That's Damon Young, author of How to Think About Exercise, talking about the great mind behind evolutionary theory, Charles Darwin.
He wrote about walking in his biographical notes, autobiographical notes, where he mentioned his love of walking, so much so that once when he was young, he was walking along an old building and he basically fell off the edge of a parapet because he was engaged in a sort of imaginative speculation while he was walking.
Darwin would walk laps around the outer edge of his property in the Kent countryside twice a day, in the morning and in the evening. He called his route the thinking path, and one can't help but wonder, did these daily strolls help shape his theory of evolution?
Walking was an opportunity for Darwin to experience what I've called walker's reverie. It's a state called transient hypofrontality, where normally a lot of our ideas and impressions are kept far apart in our mind. This is where that idea goes, and this is where that idea goes. When we're in this state of reverie, these ideas are allowed to mingle. Basically, it turns down the parts that usually organize our intellect. What happens is we have new ideas, new impressions. Ideas are allowed to mingle freely, so it's a richly creative state of mind. And Darwin spoke about the idle frame of mind he had when he was walking, where all the research he'd done all day on barnacles, for example, was allowed to bubble and froth under the surface and new ideas would come to light.
But why walking in particular, or running? What makes it such a good exercise for the brain?
Okay, firstly, because it doesn't take that much effort, physically or cognitively, to walk. So a lot of the resources that would normally be tied up in coordination are shifted into things like motor control and perception. The second thing is that when we're walking, we don't have to worry about hitting the tennis ball or dodging cars on a bike or whether our opponent's going to punch us in the snoot. What that means is we're no longer attuned in quite the same way. We're no longer analyzing or calculating. We can let our mind roam. And the third thing is, when we're walking, we're doing it at a human speed. Now, normally we're used to going around our neighborhoods or the city at 55 miles an hour, behind glass, often with the radio on.
Mm-hmm.
walking is engaging with a human world at a human pace.
Did Darwin walk for all of his life?
Yes, Darwin walked every day, and in fact, the day he had a very serious stroke that signaled his decline to death, he was walking when he was doing it, and he was saddened that he didn't get to finish his walk.
Well, today we're going to finish Darwin's all-too-human walk for him. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth from NHPR, and today we are talking all about walking and its physical, emotional, and even spiritual benefits, starting with a lesser-known aspect of the activity, its entertainment value. Long before Major League Baseball, the NFL, or NASCAR, pedestrianism was America's most popular spectator sport. In the decades after the Civil War, crowds turned out to watch competitive walkers stride around circular tracks for hours, even days. Among pedestrians, Edward Payson Weston was a cut above the rest. His walks from Boston to Washington, Maine to Chicago, and New York to San Francisco were well-covered spectacles. Sports writers analyzed his gait, an elastic swinging stride. He won piles of money, attracted sponsors, and legions of fans. The writer Wayne Curtis follows Edward Payson Weston's final pilgrimage in 1909 and contemplates the role of walking in the physical and social development of human beings in a book called The Last Great Walk. We spoke to Wayne about walking sticks while he was researching the book and are happy to welcome him back to Word of Mouth.
Well, happy to be back and happy to have the book out.
Well, just how big was competitive walking in its heyday?
It was big. I mean, it would fill Madison Square Garden, the old Madison Square Garden. People would pay the equivalent of $10 for a ticket to come sit in the stands and just watch people walk around the track. And typically the most popular ones were the six-day walks, which would start generally at midnight or after midnight on Sunday, because people didn't like to walk on Sunday. And then they'd go until midnight the following week and see who could rack up the most miles in that. And they turned out a lot of people. There was other entertainment. They'd have a band in the middle of the track, and there'd be other things going on. But it was a big deal.
Was it like race walking is now? Or, I mean, it sounds to me like more of an endurance test.
It was more endurance then. Race walking now is a little bit more like an offshoot of track and field. This seemed to be more of an offshoot of, I don't know what it was an offshoot of. I think maybe it was just its own thing. And it was typically more of an endurance race to see how far people could go. And there was wagering and there was betting, and some of it would have been Dan O'Leary versus Edward Payson Weston. But it might also be people were wagering whether somebody could do 500 miles in 6 days or whether they could do 100 miles in 24 hours, and they would bet on that.
Now, Edward Payson Weston, a true champion. Now, what drew you to this man who's pretty much almost lost to history?
I stumbled across him by accident. I'd been looking some years ago, and this will date me, through microfilm in the basement of a library, and just happened across a 1909 article about his walk to San Francisco, and it said that he was walking around 40 miles a day, and he was 70 years old, and I thought, well, that's interesting, and I scrolled on to what I was looking for, and then I thought about it, and I thought, wait a minute, 40 miles a day, 70 years old? So I scrolled back and read a little bit more and then just started gathering string about him and decided at some point that it would make a book.
He left no journals, no biographies. Now we know that he was of Brahmin stock and cut quite a figure with some bold sartorial choices. Tell us a little bit about that, and was this calculated on his part?
He knew how to generate publicity. I think people today could learn from him. Even back in the 1860s when he was racing, and he'd wear, you know, ostrich plumes in his hat, and he'd wear all sorts of fancy outfits. Typically, the race walkers would wear sort of loose linen shirts and loose pants and you know, sensible leather boots. But he tended to dress himself up, at least when he would start a race, to attract attention to himself. And then once he got going, he would strip down and look more like the others. But he understood the power of publicity and the power of eccentricity, I think, ahead of the game.
So as you mentioned, he was already 70 when he set out from New York to San Francisco. This was in 1909. And the sport was kind of on its way out. So was he proving a point? Was he, you know, being a walking John Henry up against the machine?
Well, it struck me, and when I started researching the story, and I was drawn to that 1909 walk, partly because it seemed the timing was very interesting. 1909 was the year when Henry Ford started switching over to assembly line. 1910 was when General Motors was incorporated. And it really started to feel like a John Henry tale of a man against the machine. And it was fascinating that the coverage, first of all, he attracted huge crowds. He wasn't just a solo walker. When he left New York, there were estimated 10,000 people to see him leave. And it sort of had this feel of a last farewell of something, people saying goodbye to an era in some ways. Mm-hmm. And then what struck me also in the coverage was that some really poo-pooed this. And they said, well, you know, everyone used to walk 20, 30 miles a day. It was just a matter of course. It's not that big a deal what he's doing, and why are people making such a fuss about it? And mm-hmm. to me, that was almost more fascinating. And you start realizing that around the beginning of the last century, we stopped walking as a matter of course. And I wanted to look at the fact that for 5 million years or so, give or take a millennia, we've evolved to walk upright, and we've spent 5 million years doing so. And by the research I've done, I estimate that up until a century ago, we probably walked around 8 to 12 miles a day daily, on average around the globe. And then we just sort of stopped. So I wanted to see what the effects were on that.
We're talking to the writer Wayne Curtis about The Last Great Walk. That's the name of his book. It covers the true story of a 1909 walk from New York to San Francisco. Along the way, he meditates and reflects on why walking is important, not just for physical, but social development. Now, walking is an essential part of human development as we know it, but walking, as you write, walking upright was not inevitable among our hominid ancestors, maybe determined by climate changes between 6 and 7 million years ago. So what happened there?
People are still debating this on the progress and how this switched over, but it seems likely that those who were walking upright suddenly had an evolutionary advantage. They could move longer distances and use less energy, and thereby could obtain more food, find their way from shelter out to food and back again more efficiently than the apes. And the climate change was likely, we're seeing sort of a drying out of the Great Rift Valley in Africa at the time. And so it was more savanna and less jungle. So it became more beneficial for those that could walk upright than those that could scramble from limb to limb. And mm-hmm. it just over time came to dominate entirely. And if once we were moving upright, we could move out of Central Africa and into Asia and up into Europe, and the rest is, well, quite literally history.
And in terms of human development, now human hands were free for tasks,
and
right. our brains grew.
They did. It was some million years after we were upright, but then the archaeological evidence is that our brain cases started to grow fairly rapidly after being upright for a while. And so our minds are also, it seems, tied to walking and in deep ways that, again, the question was, how is that affecting us as we stop walking?
Well, that's a question. I mean, if this was the primary means of mobility for so many years, millions of years, and so much developed out of it, what happens when we, as we're finding now, become a more sedentary society all over the world, not just here in the U.S.?
No, I still look at this as a century-long experiment in not walking. And so it's, and relative to the several million years of evolution, and it's hard to make conclusive results, but I think the early findings aren't very encouraging. We're seeing all sorts of increases in different types of diseases. Certainly obesity leads the pack, and we're just not moving the way we were. I think the average American, according to one study, walks about 5,100 steps a day, which is about 2.5 miles. As I said, as I make the case in the book, that we were evolved to walk probably 8 to 12 miles a day. That's where we seem to be in balance. And so by just cutting back how much we're walking, our balance is starting to go off. We're storing too many calories, and we've got widespread obesity. And studies are showing that other health impacts have been growing because of our a lack of walking. Some of the tests that they've done, some of the experiments about having certain people walk and certain people not walk and testing them for hypertension or stroke or type 2 diabetes, gallstones, all of these things show that you are much less liable to come up with these sorts of health problems, these chronic diseases, if you walk regularly.
Well, Wayne, in your research for the book, you visit a lazy boy factory to sort of examine sedentary life, and you also convert to pedestrianism. You do a lot of walking yourself, tracing some of the route of Payson, for one. I'm thinking, you know, in an age when our experience of landscapes is so increasingly mediated by computer graphics, you know, when driving directions on a GPS or a smartphone, or the bird's eye view on Google Maps, or or a camera on Street View. So what are we losing in the real Street View, actually seeing it through our eyes?
It seems that we're losing a sense of where we are in some ways. And there's not been a lot of research or studies on this, but some of the stuff that is coming out is fascinating, and a lot of it's coming out of the video game world. Clearly, there's a lot of money in video games. You know, seems it's poised to be, if not already, bigger than Hollywood in terms of annual revenues. So there's a lot of money to be made there. And what the research has found is that video gamers who sit on a couch with a joystick or with some thumb controls to maneuver through these virtual environments get lost really easily. They're never really quite sure where they are. It's hard to get back to the start. It's hard to figure out shortcuts. But when they've tested people with actual movement, and this is either involves a warehouse-sized space with virtual reality goggles where you can actually move and turn and proceed or reverse, or a 360-degree treadmill, which there's been some experiments on, then people know where they are. They can figure it out. There's some sort of combination of proprioceptive learning and vestibular stimulation in the brain, you know, just your balance. And walking really helps you know where you are. And I think you lose that in cars and other ways. That's just the very basic, you know, route-making skills. And it seems that our brains evolved. The most important thing that we need to know is where we are, because we need to know where the food is, where shelter is, and so much of the rest of our thinking revolves around that sort of cognitive mapping. And it's hard to do that if you're not out and about and moving.
So when you're following Edward Payson Weston, you have this kind of meditations on what walking means to all of us. And, you know, how about Payson? His story did not end particularly well. What happened to him?
He did keep walking. Much later in life, after he walked from New York to San Francisco, the following year he walked from Los Angeles back to New York. Even into his 80s, he was doing some walks from Buffalo to New York City. Got into his late 80s, he was stepped off a curb in New York and was hit by a taxi cab, which is
of all the things,
yeah. And he was quite ahead of his time, railing against cigarette smoking he thought was unhealthful, and he railed against the laziness of youth who were always getting around by either a streetcar or by car. And he was ahead of his time in that, and so it is ironic that he was hit by a car, didn't die instantly. He actually lived for another couple of years, but he was bedridden, was never able to get out on his walks again. Lived to just slightly over 90 years old before he died.
Wayne Curtis, rescuing Edward Payson Weston from obscurity. Thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks for speaking to me. Thanks.
Wayne Curtis is author of The Last Great Walk. There's much more on the book at wordofmouthradio.org.
Well, John Henry was a little baby sitting on his daddy's knee. He picked up a hammer and a little piece of steel and cried, "Hammer's gone."
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. From early Christian pilgrims on the Camino de Santiago to the Islamic pilgrimage to Mecca to the meditative walks advocated by Buddhists, walking is a symbolic act across religions. But there is a walking ritual that predates Moses, Christ, Buddha, and Muhammad, the labyrinth. Eunice Schroeder found a new path for her life through this ancient practice. Producer Julie Sabatier brings us the story.
Walking a labyrinth is an ancient ritual that invites everyone to interpret in their own way. Eunice Schroeder teaches religious studies at Merrillhurst University in Oregon, with a focus specifically on labyrinths.
One of the things that I like to always say first when I use the word labyrinth is it's not a maze, because a lot of people get confused about that, thinking it's some kind of corn maze or, you know, that you could get lost or trapped or have a dead end. But we use the word labyrinth for a complex, meandering, single pathway to a center.
I met Eunice at a labyrinth outside a church near her home in Vancouver, Washington. It's a winding brick path that loops around several times, but it is continuous. As we began walking it, she told me that while many churches have labyrinths, this is a ritual that transcends religion.
The labyrinth predates Christianity by a long shot. We're talking, you know, 3500 BC, the first labyrinths that were found carved on cave walls. So no, it's not about any one religion at all, and that's one of the things I love about it.
Eunice discovered labyrinths about 12 years ago when she faced a personal crisis.
You know, the first time I walked a labyrinth, I wasn't that impressed. I thought, well, this is really interesting, but it's kind of crazy. Like, what's the point? We're just walking in circles here.
But the second time around, she had a different experience.
When I got to the middle and sat down and just rested there, I just really felt this profound peace and quiet that I really, really, really needed in my life. And I just started crying, and I cried buckets and buckets and buckets of tears. And I thought, what in the world is going on here? But there was some kind of release for me walking this pathway.
It wasn't long after that that Eunice decided to return to school to study religion. She did a master's thesis on labyrinths. In 1999, she started Sacred Journey Ministries, an organization designed to teach people about the ritual of walking a labyrinth. She has two canvas labyrinths that she brings with her to all kinds of places.
Schools, hospitals, retreat centers, rehab centers, prisons, whoever invites me, and I invite them to try this sacred journey. So this has become my work. This has become my ministry. It's really, really satisfying.
As we wound our way around the curving pathway of the brick labyrinth, Eunice explained how she sees it as a metaphor for life.
There's lots of U-turns, but if you think about it, isn't that what life is? Isn't that what happens to us? And if you stand back as we are now and look at the entire pattern, okay? Because in the middle of a crisis, you're stuck looking at just that curve and going, no, I don't want to do that. I don't want to turn here. I want to keep going straight, right? But as you stand back and look at the entire pattern, it's beautiful. There's nothing wrong here. There's no mistakes. This is all a beautiful pattern.
She says people often come to the labyrinth with a question and treat the ritual as a kind of walking meditation. But that's just one way to do it.
It didn't come with an instruction manual. Zero, zip, okay? So you can do whatever you want with it. It's a calming ritual, even if you didn't think about a thing on the way, okay? It's not like you have to think hard about something.
I did feel calm. The sun was shining, there were birds calling to each other in the trees. It's a very peaceful spot. And it's pretty cool to think that there are people putting their own spin on this ritual all around the world.
And that piece came to us from Julie Sabatier, host and producer of Destination DIY. The labyrinth provided a path to build spiritual energy. For journalist and UNH professor Tom Haynes, the path to greater understanding cut through an oil field. Last summer, Tom embarked on a project he calls Fuel Walk. His goal is to explore on foot some of the places where America's energy is produced. We spoke to him then, just after he walked through the thriving oil fields of North Dakota. His most recent trek covered 100 miles of the Marcellus Shale. That's around the New York State-Pennsylvania border. It is the epicenter of the fracking boom. We'll talk about that trip in just a moment. But for comparison's sake, I asked Tom to remind us of his trek through North Dakota's suddenly prosperous McKenzie County.
It was the prairie. It was wide open. Everything was exposed. Wind came in fast. Rain fell heavy. There was a tornado while I was there. And so what was interesting from a landscape perspective is everything felt exposed. You felt like you could see everything. And
oil fields.
Yeah. I mean, this was, so I was in the center of the oil field, did a 70-mile route and right through the boom. And so, yeah, you'd turn one direction and there would be a, 200-foot tall oil, drilling rig. Then there'd be an oil pad. And then there'd be trucks. And then there would be alfalfa pasture. And then there would be a farmer on his tractor. And then there'd be a little old decaying farmhouse. And then there'd be a big new farm shed. So it was everything, sort of spinning. You could kind of spin through the layers of time of the place.
An instant boomtown popping up on the prairie in McKenzie County. Now, this is compared to where you walked most recently through southern New York and Pennsylvania, a place where communities are long established. Tell me about that experience.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't, it's the other end of the country to some degree and in many ways different. And certainly to listeners on the East Coast, much more familiar. This is the Eastern Woodlands. I started in what's known as the Southern Tier of New York. So sort of in a town called Dryden outside of Ithaca in the Finger Lakes region, and walked south and crossed into Pennsylvania, into Susquehanna County. To show you how different it was from North Dakota, right before I went, I was talking to a lawyer on the phone in the area who traveled a lot. And he said, look, this is going to be two-dimensional. In North Dakota, you could see everything. Here, you're walking down wooded lanes. You're going up and over hills. Things are set back. You won't see stuff. He said, the only things you'll see are things that aren't blocked. Hmm. And he was right in the sense of just the perception that you had or that I had. Walking down the road, oftentimes I couldn't see more than 300 yards down the road if there was a bend in the road. And yet, what I found was really cool, and this kind of gets to the whole walking thing, is still the exposure to different elements of the place. I would be talking to someone and say, oh, well, just up there around the bend is a gas well. Why don't you hop in my, went out for a ride in one of these Rangers. It's like a big ATV. Mm-hmm. And we went shooting up a bunch of back roads and down on the little narrower trails and popped up on a fracking site, a huge well pad, dozens of trucks and trailers and the drill. And yet you could walk 300 yards away from it on the other side of the trees and not know it's there.
Well, why did you start in New York? There's a moratorium on fracking now.
Yeah. So what was interesting in North Dakota, real quick, the story there was it was like kind of the thick of the boom. Things were going on and there was almost like a frenzy, at least from my experience where I was. And so everybody was just kind of in the doing of it, right? The drilling. And in the East, what was interesting to me and what drew me here was that two other sides of it. In New York, they kind of have thrown up their hands so far and said, stop, there's a moratorium. And it's very political, and that's, how these things get sorted out. But people have said, wait a minute, we need to study this. We need to look at the impacts of fracking. We need to see whether we really want this here in our place. Then I crossed into Pennsylvania, where fracking has been going on for even a few years longer than in North Dakota. And so it's literally, you could not cross from sort of one extreme to the other. I was walking in New York and there was a football game on the side of the road, like a middle school football game, the first of the season, quiet, nothing going on. And within a mile of crossing into Pennsylvania, there were two gas wells drilling. Mm-hmm. And people excited about it in Pennsylvania. There's a lot of sense in this in this part of the country, in these rural areas that have been economically challenged for a long time. There aren't a lot of jobs. There's not a lot of money. And someone comes along and says, hey, you're sitting on a ton of natural gas that we'll pay you a lot of money for. And that doesn't always work out that way, but that's the promise. It's interesting how people see the land they live on, right? There's some who sort of see it through this, what I would sort of describe as sort of a shorter term resource lens, right? This can be turned into money for me and my family, and that's fine. That brings a lot of good stuff, right? You can send somebody to school, you can pay off bills, you can pay off debts. Other people say sort of almost much more on this longer term lens of no, wait a minute, this place has always been here. If we tap into this, it might even just change my happiness here. It might be louder and, it could be something. It doesn't necessarily have to be deeply environmental as much as just kind of somebody wanting to preserve things the way they are. Mm. And so, I agree that that's one of the fascinating things about walking through is you see so many different sides.
Yeah. What is it about walking that sort of gives you a different perspective?
Well, I mean, part of it for me relative to this project was what we're talking about is kind of these fuels that accelerate our modern life, right? We're talking about gas and coal and oil, whether it's in a car or in a plane or whatever. And I thought, so specific to that, I thought, wow, to go into these places and walk just to slow down. And there's a tradition of this, both for sort of the traveler, also journalists. There's a journalist, Paul Salopek, who's walking around the world for 7 years, sort of tracing the roots of humankind. But so I think there's that sort of philosophical effort of kind of to play with time a little bit. If I slow down and kind of move at a slower level, I will quote, I was reading a book about walking actually that cited Ralph Waldo Emerson, and I'll read this so that I don't butcher it. Sure. But he said, the ground is all memoranda and signatures and every object covered over with hints. Right? He was talking about nature. But I think if you apply that to sort of how we live off the land and these decisions we're making as a society, to move through that slowly, it's not like you're going to see every hint. It's not like you're going to understand every hint. But I feel certainly as a writer and as a journalist, I'm going to notice a lot more. I'm going to be exposed to a lot more of these hints about what the stories are along the way. So that's the big motivation. I think also, you know, there's something to be said for just the practical encounters you have. I had a day where I had to go 20 miles through the Susquehanna, Pennsylvania, and I just assumed, you know, having lived in the East, that, oh, over 20 miles, there's going to be a gas station. There's going to be a place to buy some water. That wasn't the case. It was a 20-mile route on two-lane roads that there was nothing. And so I knew at one point in the day I was just going to have to walk up and knock on somebody's door and say, hey, can I sleep in your yard with my sleeping bag and my tent? And I did. And I ended up hanging out with his family for the whole evening and the next morning and hearing their story.
And that's not an encounter that's always easy to happen. I mean, I imagine it out in oil boom country. Everybody's new, right?
Yeah.
You know, they're all sort of, they've just migrated there. They're willing to talk to you maybe in a different way than back east, which has a chillier kind of reputation.
Yes, a bit chillier. And you're right. I mean, out in the oil boom, there was a certain kind of expected chaos from everybody, I think, that kind of anything goes. So a guy walking down the road with a backpack, although I was the only one, and so in some ways people were sort of taken back by that. They pretty quickly were like, oh, he must be out doing something, must have a reason to be here. In the East, certainly, you know, these are areas that are, there's a lot more traffic, there's a lot more cars. Everybody I met to a person almost would say, can I just give you a ride? You're going fire 10 miles. Look, I'll run you down. It'll be 10 minutes for me to drive you down there. I'll get you there, and then you can keep on walking. Almost as though, you know, I was, you know, this, well, that'll help you because you can skip that part of walking. And I'd sort of say, but no, that's the idea.
Did you ever talk to anybody who had made a decision to lease and questioned it and thought maybe I shouldn't have done this?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I will say, first of all, I talked to many people who leased and were happy with it.
Yeah.
You know, they were waiting, you know, again, that financial calculus or just even this sense that there's a confidence that these companies know what they're doing. We need natural gas. It's interesting. I came into the town of Little Meadows, Pennsylvania, which is right on the border of New York. And so this is, you know, effectively crossing into an area where they're now where they're fracking. And they were drilling wells. And the town was all excited. I mean, I was in the post office because they had been waiting 5 years for the wells to get drilled, because until the wells were drilled, they weren't going to see any royalties. This was the summer that the Talisman, the company, had come in to drill. And they were trading stories of, yeah, they've been pretty good to me, you know, the drilling and all this stuff, the crews. But what happens here is this industrialization comes in stages. And so I met in that town a woman who sort of happily enough had signed a lease. But then the gas company came back and said, oh, by the way, we want to run the gas pipeline through your backyard. She had a 10-acre wooded lot. I mean, the country is very similar in some ways to New Hampshire, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you've got these wooded lots. And so they had to cut a 100-foot wide swath.
Wow.
They leased that, but she then kind of regretted that. And then they came back and said, oh, we want to run the water pipeline through your front yard and underneath your driveway for a while up to so that we can fret. You know, my point being that I think what happens is it's a very intimate and individual process that goes on your land when the development occurs. And so people start to say, wow, what have, you know, some people certainly, in any case, what have we signed up for?
Tom Haines, thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thanks a lot, Virginia.
Tom Haines is a journalist and journalism professor at UNH in Durham. He's keeping track of his walks through America's energy environments on his blog, Fuel Walk. There's a link to it at wordofmouthradio.org.
I'm walking, hear the need, I'm talking. By you and me, I'm hoping that you come back to me.
Up next on Word of Mouth, a walk across the country gone wrong.
What you gonna do when the well run dry? You gonna run away and hide. I'm gonna run right by your side. For you, pretty baby, I even die. I'm walking. Yes, indeed, I'm talking. For you and me, I'm hoping that you come back to me.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You've certainly heard the story. Person walks across the country to bring attention to a variety of noble and worthy causes. And they pretty much all end the same. the hero is welcomed home. We rarely hear about the ones who didn't make it or who gave up halfway. In 1992, NHBR's Sean Hurley tried to walk across the country and failed. And while he may not have achieved what he set out to do, he did document his journey on a handheld cassette recorder.
Lying in bed right now, it's getting around 7:15. I can tell by the sound of my voice I'm a little dazed. Just hard to believe that I have 150 more nights out, 150 more days of walking 20 miles or so.
It was February 20th, 1992, and it was the first day of my walk across the country. 20 snowy miles from Cambridge to Sudbury, Massachusetts, I'd set my tent up in the woods beside Longfellow's famous Wayside Inn and sat in my sleeping bag with a handheld tape recorder and read what I had just written in my journal.
There is no such interconnectedness in the universe. All things are alone and isolated. All atoms are spaced appropriately. The only connection is accident.
I was a fan of Democritus's idea on the nature of the universe, that the totality consisted only of atoms, motion, and the void. No sentimental meaning to be found, no story to be unraveled. The next morning, I rose and packed my atoms and began my motion, having no idea I was headed directly into the void.
I'm trying to drink as little as possible.
I didn't mean water. I was 24 years old, and I already knew what I was. I'd been drinking almost daily for 4 years. I was an alcoholic and couldn't find a way to not be. The simple hardship of walking across the country, I figured and hoped, might be my only cure. On my second day, I stepped into a bar.
Rained a little bit last night, and I got a little too drunk at Mondo's. I hope not to do that again.
I wanted to be a writer, but my constant drinking had dropped me into a constant depression.
I want to put myself back under the spell of living, and I have lost it.
I'm a lot like my grandfather, and a lot like his son too, I guess. So they say. My Uncle Dick. Both were effortlessly charming, which I've never been, and both full of life. And maybe I shared their looks. It's what my mother said, my grandmother, or my aunts. You're so like your grandfather, they'd say. So like your Uncle Dick.
I'd like to take some kind of an oath or allegiance for one big spiritual, personal, world truth that I would like to try, be faithful to.
Democritus's atoms, motion, and the void were not a belief system. They were facts, not a faith. And though I wanted to find something to believe in, it would have to be a truth beyond question. Something I just knew was true.
I'm beginning to think it's all that I came on this walk for. Finding the center is what I'm doing.
My grandfather stayed with us every summer, all summer. He'd sit on our porch, we'd play cards, he'd smoke and sing and talk. He had dozens of old card player expressions. He'd accuse me of laying back in the weeds, of dancing on my heels. From Natchez to Mobile, he'd sing in a smoky voice.
From Natchez to Mobile, from Memphis to St. Joe, wherever the four winds.
He'd talk about the great tragedy of his life, the loss of his only son, a magically attractive genius boy who came home wrecked from Vietnam and died in what was called a canoe accident. Really, his canoe had tipped over in a calm and shallow river, and my Uncle Dick was too drunk to swim.
I can't believe it's only been 2 days. It seems like a month already. But I suppose I'll have to get used to that. Or, not getting used to that, I'll have to break into a thousand little pieces.
My grandfather wasn't shy about his past. I knew he was in and out of the gutter, here and there, homeless, on and mostly off the wagon. He lived in a monastery for a while, in shelters, in charity homes, and on the street. His wife left him, his daughters, even my mother, who let him come stay with us, Didn't want to see him.
Well, I drank too much. And hopefully I won't drink very much into the future. It's getting a little silly.
I didn't drink until college. I abstained. A teetotaler, like my mother. I went to plenty of parties in high school where drinking was the main attraction, but I'd sit by the stereo with a Coke and listen to the music and marvel at my restraint.
I went into the bar room. It was a very small, very dark, about six tables, all with little candles on them.
I got a scholarship to a little Ivy League school, not because I was smart, but because I could run fast. I ran a 4:12 mile my freshman year, fast enough to get my coach talking about the Olympics, fast enough to start talking about sub-4-minute miles. Drinking ended that my sophomore year. I quit the track team, lost my scholarship, stopped running.
Last night I stayed in a broken-down shack filled with mason jars and chairs and old farming tools.
By the end of the first week of my walk, I was drinking during the day. And like some kind of landlubber pirate for me, that meant singing.
I'm gonna mush this skull with my crawdad armpit. I'm gonna bust some bones on my way to hell. I'm thirsty from drinking too much. I'm just kind of dying and no good.
I've never listened to these 22-year-old microcassettes until now.
When I'm feeling blue, all I have to do is cast a look at you, and I'm free.
I went away for a semester abroad in Ireland my junior year. I didn't attend a single class. I woke up in fields beside the ocean, with cuts and bruises on my body from falling down. I wasn't effortlessly charming. I wasn't smart. I wasn't full of life. But in one way, at least, I was just like my grandfather.
I think you were somebody that was, in a way, maybe having a kind of breakdown.
At the time I left for the walk, I was living with my best friend, Chris, in a house in Watertown.
I remember when you left, and you were a broken-up person.
Chris worked at a liquor store, delivered newspapers at 4 in the morning, but every night he and I would go down to the basement and play music. We had a small amp, a mic, a couple guitars, a drum machine, a tape recorder, and whatever liquor we could get. Chris would play, and I would sing.
You were just making up lyrics on the spot that rhymed and sounded great and had little stories. And like, I listened to things we did, I'm like, oh, he sounds exactly like The Cure, or oh, he sounds exactly like Morrissey, and oh, he's doing his Michael Stipe, and it's perfect.
But I had no voice of my own. Only borrowed voices.
We knew that you were not right. You drank an extreme amount of booze all the time, and I was quite the drinker also, but I couldn't keep up with you, and you would just keep going. You needed to straighten yourself out, and that was your way of doing it.
As a poet, musician, and all-around artist, Chris decided to film some parts of my walk with a Super 8 camera.
You know, in a way, maybe in the back of my mind, I thought, well, I'll do some Wim Wenders-type black-and-white thing of guy walking on these barren roads.
Chris and a friend came and went and shot the guy walking on the barren roads. And then, as he was nearly out of film, he suggested a sit-down interview in Pennsylvania.
You took a long time to answer our questions, and you were really not articulate. Like, you couldn't communicate to us. You seemed like you weren't doing too well.
Here's his first question. Had anything surprised me so far about the walk?
Surprised? Not really surprised. Not surprised. Just slightly. I'm sort of easing into that a bit.
Cut. We would ask you a question, and you would pause and think for what seemed to me an excruciatingly long period of time before you started saying anything. And when you did speak, I could not understand what you were talking about. I really couldn't.
I pushed on through Pennsylvania. My inability to communicate deepened.
I think I'll be somewhat speechless.
I stopped writing in my journal. I stopped recording on the handheld. I kept drinking. I kept walking. I crossed through Ohio. Deciding that I was done is the last clear memory I have. Things began to dissolve. There's a blank space that stretches out and never clearly ends. I know I kept walking, but I was no longer there.
It seemed to me like you were gone for years.
Eventually, I returned home. I don't know how or when.
But somehow when you got back, it fixed you whether you like it or not. Or maybe it was like electroshock and you weren't fully cured, but you were put back together by the time you got back.
I drank less, took long breaks from drinking. I started running again and writing. My walk across the country was not a triumph. My rock bottom lay below the rocks, below the bottom. Rather than walking across the country, I'd walked into the death of my first self. I'd hoped to find the center, but what I found instead was the void. I haven't had a drink in a long time now. I run every day or walk. I write stories and songs and plays. I still don't sing in my own voice. This isn't my real voice. I don't know if I have one. In 2006, I began a podcast called Adam's Motion in the Void. I improvise stories using a made-up voice because a false voice has always felt more comfortable, authentic. What began with my descent into the void ended up the finale of my first play, also called Adam's Motion and the Void.
In a rushing rainbow crystal, every image, every story, every observation from my life in a torrent of light. And I said farewell to each in the only way one can, with the kiss of forgiveness.
The story of a man who's lost his way, his sense of self, and who's forced to bear witness to his own death, and through that, learns a big spiritual world truth that he doesn't need to believe in. He simply knows it's true.
To know that one dies into the vortex of one's own birth, and that all beings, animals, and matter, whether stone or tree, bear forth from the selfsame emptiness and return there when complete. To die in one's own arms, as ever one has been, invisible, strong, transparent, clear, cradled thereby in the crucible of the hands of God, which is nothing but love. Which is nothing but the self, which is nothing but the universe, which then, in its fulfillment, may be said to be comprised of this self-same trinity alone, of atoms, motion, and the void.
My mother came to me after the play, are so like, she whispered as she embraced me, your grandfather. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sean Hurley.
If you'd like to see some Super 8 video of Sean's journey, as well as some photos, you can find him on our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
When you walk through a storm. Hold your head up high and don't be afraid of the dark.
Thank you for taking a stroll with us today. If you missed any leg of today's show, you can catch it in its entirety with the Word of Mouth podcast. There's a link to subscribe. That's at wordofmouthradio.org or by searching Word of Mouth NHPR on iTunes. And if you like the podcast, please tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us for more Word of Mouth tomorrow, too, right here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Walk on through the wind. Walk on. And blow.